You guys remember that from last week? Some of you do. We were. This is an old Victrola. This is old technology. It goes way back. It's before most of our time, probably all of our time. But we made a couple of points with it. And let me just help you. We're grateful that we have a faith that reaches back across the generations. We're grateful that it reaches all the way back, that we can look even at things like the New Testament and know that the manuscript evidence tells us that this was handed down faithfully through the generations. But the last point I made was that this can't just be like listening to an old Victrola. Like, our faith can't be grandma's faith. It's got to be our faith. It can't seem so distant and so far away. So the question that we probably ought to ask is the same question that Jesus asked his disciples one day when he said, "Who do you say that I am?" You see, I think ultimately that's what this is going to come down to, is just this idea of who do we say that Jesus is? In fact, I would suggest to you that it's probably the linchpin of everything when it comes to the Christian faith. Christmas in June, really? Some of you are like, yes, I'll listen to this anytime. Others of you, you kind of feel like I might have broken the 11th commandment, right? You play this only after Thanksgiving, right? Okay, so here's my point. I think the last line of this song, granted, it's being sung in Latin, but the last line of this song is the answer to the question. Who is Jesus? Venite adoremus Dominum. Oh, come let us adore him, Christ the Lord. That word Lord is loaded. In the Greek, it is the word kyrios. And we said last week that when Paul and others are using it, they're using it with the same kind of weight that Hebrew writers would have done for what we would call the Old Testament when they say God. When you see Lord in the New Testament, you might as well think God. So what's the point? Jesus is God. That's who he is. And we studied in John 1 last week that he's not just God, but that he is God in the flesh. He really lived on this earth, and there are fancy terms that the church councils use, and we're not going to get into that. There were even debates about what really, like who Jesus was in the coming centuries. We admitted that, and there were these heresies that you're seeing up there. Some people said, yeah, he was human, but he wasn't God, or he was God and he wasn't human. I'm so grateful for like an African bishop named Athanasius who in the early centuries said, no, he's both. He's both. He is God and he is man. Without that, Christianity falls apart. He fits in no category. He really is the one and only. Now, Paul makes that statement and he makes that point in many of his writings. We've already read from Philippians 2. It's a biggie. I want you to now go to the book of Colossians. It's one of the other major texts that you can look at when it comes to understanding just how big a deal Jesus is. So just for those keeping score, we've read John 1, Philippians 2, and now Colossians 1. You want to earmark all of those as you begin to understand your Bible, because this is a biggie. Here's some background for you. Paul is a church planter in the first century. This is probably between 60 and 62 AD when he's writing this. He's writing this most likely from Rome. By the way, I want to just say hello to those of you who are joining us from places like Italy in Europe and Saudi Arabia and Malaysia and South America and all of our sites. I mean, we're doing this together, okay? But Paul wrote this letter from Rome while he was in prison. He's in prison for preaching the gospel. He's never been to Colossae. It's a city in western Turkey. We'd call it Turkey. He's got friends that are from there, and they're giving him a report of what's going on. So 60, 61, 62 AD, he writes this letter while he's in prison, and he's going to correct a couple of things. There's some cool stuff going on in Colossae, but there's also some weird stuff happening. One of the things that was going on was they were approaching truth the way some of us approach the old country buffet. Let me show you what I mean. What I mean by that is it was just like everybody gets to fill up their plate with whatever they want, and what works for me works for me. What works for you works for you. But our plates are not going to look the same. So somebody can walk through and they got a pork chop and some cream corn and bread pudding and head cheese and Skittles. And for them, that's a meal. And you go, well, that doesn't work. And somebody says, what do they say? Well, it works for me. What works for you works for you. Does any of that sound familiar? So this mix and match spirituality led to people then actually denying that Jesus was a big deal. In fact, they would say things like, well, he's spiritual, like he's a guide. He's a spiritual guide. He's a great guy, but he's not God. Does any of that sound familiar? Paul now writes this letter to correct some things, and along the way, he will answer the question in depth, who is this Jesus? Colossians 1, if you have your Bibles, we'll start with verse 15. We're just going to read a handful of verses. Believe me, that's enough. The Son, he's referring to Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him. And for him, he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. Now, there's a lot there, and here's what we're going to do to understand it. What we often do around here. I'm going to ask you, if you would, to just kind of break up into some little groups and talk to each other one more time. Why do we do that? First of all, in this world, in this time, we have amazingly short attention spans. So this is a way for us to stay engaged. It's that. Another thing going on here is it's a chance for, and I think this is important, it's a chance in each of our rooms, hello, Fenton, Mid Rivers, Grants Trail, Chesterfield, it's a chance for there to be other voices heard in this room besides mine. I think that's really important. Third thing is it teaches you to kind of pull apart the text and say, it's okay to ask hard questions. Let's see what's there. And then the last thing is, it allows you to be nice to your neighbors, which I think is always important. And that means you get to invite people who are sitting around you to join you in this thing. If you see somebody sitting around you who doesn't look like they have anybody with them, or they don't, you know, just invite them. Invite them tenderly. Do not go in hot going, you're going to be a part of our group. Don't do that. But just very tenderly say, hey, you want to come in and join us? You can just sit on the edges, whatever. Here's what you're going to do. Two things. What do you see, Paul? Why does he say this? What are the big points? You tell me. You're going to preach this. And then secondly, what questions do you have? Because if it were me, I'd have some questions. There was some kind of loaded language in there. So you can dial this up on your phone. You can look at this. You do whatever you want to do. We'll give you some of these references. But just if you would now, what questions do you have and what points was Paul trying to make? Sites, you know how to reach us. Talk to each other. All right, we could keep this going for a while, but let's just see what you've got. We'll start, and then you guys just interrupt and tell us what's coming from the sites, Anthony. But, like, what are the points that Paul's trying to make? If you were preaching this, what do we need to notice here? And then what questions do we have? We'll start with the points. What's Paul trying to say here? Anybody got anything? You getting anything from the sites?
Yeah, Grant Trellis says, if we see Jesus, we see the invisible God. And then in Mid Rivers, first among the dead, 3 question marks.
Okay, all right. So a point and a question. Yeah. So the first thing, let's just stay with the points. He is, when you see him, you see the invisible God. Okay, that is absolutely a point that's being made. Anybody else seeing anything there? Any other big points? Yeah.
He's been here the whole time.
There's a big thing. He's trying to make sure that we understand there's a fancy term for this. He is pre-existent. And we kind of talked about that last week, too. He just has always been, which, by the way, is a category buster, right? Because nobody else gets to say that. All right, what else? Anything else? Yep, in the back.
Creator.
He's creator. Yes, Jesus is creator. We saw that last week, too. By him and through him, all things are made. Okay, what else? He holds it all together. That sounds so good and so, like, impossible.
He's the Vanderbilt's horses.
Yeah. Okay, what else? So we've got some points. Any other questions? Anybody else look at that firstborn stuff and go, yeah, that sounds like, I don't know, like, especially the second time it's used. Did you notice it was used twice? Firstborn among the dead. Anybody else go, that's creepy? Let me tell you what some of us do, even if we've been around Scripture for a long time. Here's what we do. We're in, we believe, we love Jesus. But we will come across a phrase sometimes in Scripture that kind of sort of makes us nervous, freaks us out. Here's what we do. Firstborn among the, no, I don't know what that means, but I love Jesus, so I'm just going to keep moving.
No, we're going to pull this apart, okay? So let's start, and it'll make the point. Somebody said in a previous service that he is supreme. There's a supremacy there, and this person said, that makes me nervous. Because when people are in that much power, it's not good. Okay, so how about this? The first thing that you guys were saying, when we see Jesus, we see the invisible God. He is the image of the invisible God. A little bit of Greek here, not much, but the word there in the Greek is the word icon. Now, just let's all go out on a limb. You're good. Like, what English word do we get from the Greek word icon? All together now? Icon. What is an icon? An icon is a representation of something. It is something that you see, this physical. It's just something that represents something. We use this term all the time. What's an icon of heroism? Like, if you just like the profile of heroism. What, anybody got somebody or a kind of somebody that you go, yeah, that's the icon of heroism? Anybody got anything? Superman, every service. We got to let go of these superhero movies, guys. No, Superman, that's absolutely what. Anything in the, yes, in the back. I saw that hand, bring it. So God is an icon of heroism. We do see God as hero. Okay, what else? Anybody got anything? The Purple Heart. So we would just say in general, any kind of heroic act in the military in particular, that's an iconic thought there. Somebody is saying first responders. Yeah, so we've got our law enforcement, our fire, our EMTs. These are the people they are the people who run into the chaos when the rest of us run away from it, right? How about this? I was thinking about this week. I was going to, yesterday, I used the icon of basketball greatness, and then we got into a whole LeBron debate, and I don't want to do that, okay? Was his hand broken, not broken, all of that stuff. So let's just go closer to home for many of us. Now, those of you watching around the world, I want to explain something. We're in St. Louis, and baseball is a big deal in St. Louis. Now, if you do not understand baseball, it's like cricket, only I understand it. Okay, so that's baseball. But we lost this week, and people even use that term. We lost an iconic figure in St. Louis Cardinals baseball, Red Shandies, right? And so it's like, yeah, he just represents what I love about the Cardinals. There was. He just represents that. Now, let me tell you what. We can talk about this all day long. We can talk about the icon. Like, what's the icon of the best pet ever? What's the icon of a great pet? Lassie. I notice you're all saying dogs. Flipper, really? Flipper? All right, who said that? Did you say that? Flipper? Okay. All right. Yeah, okay. Yep, yep. I don't care what you say. It can be, it can be dog, cat. Had somebody say snake. Snake is the perfect pet. You know, they're low maintenance. They stay in an aquarium. You just feed them a dead frozen mouse every few weeks, and it's good to go. I'm like, that doesn't sound perfect at all to me. So I don't care if it's a snake, a dog, a cat, Flipper, a tarantula, or an aardvark. It doesn't matter. Whatever your icon is, it will not fully live up to the expectation. Okay? None of them do. Now, let me give you a little bit more background of what was going on historically. In the early 60s AD, there was something rumbling through the world. People were excited about a new leader. He was the new leader of the world empire known as the Roman Empire. This new leader was a young leader. Everybody was tired of old Claudius, and this new young leader, he's going to clear the courts of corruption. He's going to work better with the Senate. He's going to keep us out of war. All of this was language that was being used, and the name of that young leader coming onto the scene was Nero. Nero. And some of you are like, well, wait, I think Nero was a bad guy. His first 4 or 5 years were great. Most historians say he did a great job, and there was a lot of hope on him. Anybody have a coin? Like, I know nobody carries coins anymore, but somebody scrounge up a coin for me, all right? We're just going to take another offering here. Thank you. All right. Whether it's here, whether it's the Roman Empire, whether it's a country that you visit, usually you can tell by the images, the icons on the coin, who's a big deal. This is George Washington. In our country, in our culture, he's a big deal. In the Roman era, you could tell who was a big deal by the coinage. So every time a new emperor came along, there was coinage, but there was something else that was going on. You looked at the coins very closely, and in Latin, you would see things like Son of God. You see, there was this emperor worship thing that was going on. There were many gods in the Roman world, but they included their emperors as so-called gods. They had temples built, statues built. When Nero takes office, as it were, they convene the Senate and declare his stepdad a god so that they can now call Nero the son of God. You see how that works? I want you to understand how revolutionary Paul's words are. Paul is saying to people living in the Roman Empire, looking to this new leader with hope, Paul is saying in a world saturated with images and icons and temples and statues, there is one God. Jesus is Lord, not Caesar. Jesus is the spitting image of the one true God. This is big. And he builds the rest of his case off of that. Now, I want to make sure everyone sees me. No way am I keeping that. Do you have any idea the emails I'll get on that? He now builds his case, and it goes back to some of this business with the firstborn and stuff like that. So let's answer that. We're not going to get into like Greek. We're not going to get into the weeds, all right? I wouldn't be able to find my way out. We're not going to talk about the genitive case of this word, and we're just not. But there are many ways that you can read this word firstborn. Let me tell you one way you can't read it. It doesn't mean first created. Jesus wasn't created. There's a perfectly good word for that, and Paul doesn't use it. In fact, he says that he's been around forever. He is pre-existent. Okay, so then what does it mean? Does it just mean first? Well, it could mean that, and he is first. He's before everything else. He says that. It's a little bit of what I think he means when he's used the second time, the firstborn from among the dead, because he said he's the beginning of the firstborn from among the dead. He is the first one who was resurrected in the way Jesus was resurrected. Now, let me just help you with this real quickly. When Lazarus was resurrected, Lazarus died. So that poor guy died twice. But when Jesus was resurrected, he stepped out of that tomb completely different in a built for eternity body. It was so different. It was so much more that even the disciples sometimes couldn't recognize him. Ooh, that's what you have to look forward to. He is the first. He's the prototype of what we have to look forward to. Now, that's a big statement of faith that I'm making, but I think there's evidence to support the resurrection, and we can talk about that offline if you want. But this idea of firstborn, so it means first, but it can also mean, let's go back to the other one and I'll help you with it. It can also mean who gets the inheritance. Now, we're not going to get into family dynamics and all of that stuff, because sometimes it wasn't technically the first child, but firstborn was the person who had the special relationship with the father, and that person gets the inheritance. So they are preeminent. They're top rung. So what this is saying here is that Jesus has created all things. He predates all things. He is above all things, and at the end of the end of the end, it's all his. He gets the full inheritance. There's an old Dutch philosopher, theologian named Abraham Kuyper. I'm going to paraphrase it, but he says, there's not one square inch of the universe where Jesus can't point to and say, mine. It's all his. That's why Paul then goes on a roll and says, he's over all rulers, all kingdoms, all people, all beings, visible and invisible. It's Jesus, and he is above it all. Do you have any idea who you're dealing with when you're dealing with Jesus? Now, one of the ways for us to understand this, kind of to get a sense of this, is to look at creation, because he is the one who created, one of you said it, created everything. Again, there's a ticking time bomb in here, and we'll get to it in a second, and it'll go off. But first, let's just look at creation. How big is the universe anyway? Well, I don't know. It's sort of a theoretical question, and I'm not even going to try to answer that. But I will tell you, we can give a sense of just one little corner of the universe. This is old technology, like 20 or so years old. But the Hubble Space Telescope, they looked and they aimed in a very dark spot right above the Big Dipper in the nighttime sky where there weren't any stars. There wasn't any light that was going to get in the way. And for 10 days, they aimed that telescope in one spot, and it was like they were just going deeper and deeper into space, deeper and deeper. They just wanted to get in. There was a dark area where they wanted to go as far into it as they could without other stars getting in the way. And after 10 days in this one spot focused, this is what they have. It is the Hubble Deep Field. This is an image from that telescope. Now, just so you understand this, those aren't stars. Those are galaxies of stars. Those are thousands upon hundreds of thousands of millions of stars. Now, when you look at this and you see the teeny tiny red dots, from what I could gather and read, the tiny red dots are estimated to be about 12 billion light years from Earth. Do you have any idea how many linear miles are represented by 12 billion light years? Yeah, me either, but it sounds like a lot. It's like 70 sextillion miles. That's 70 with a whole bunch of zeros. And what does that mean? It means the universe is really, really big. But it's more than that. If Jesus is who he claims to be, then he is present in the most distant galaxy, and he is closer than my next breath. Now, that's really heavy, but it's important. Now the time bomb goes off. You see, some of us are comfortable with the idea of awe when we study the universe theoretically, and we like the idea of awe. In fact, we think it's healthy to be reminded that there is more out there than us. Most of us, you know, it's good. It's emotional. It's almost a spiritual experience, we'll say. If we're standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon or a beautiful sunset on the beach or someplace, and it's like, oh, yeah, this is a lot, or the nighttime sky, it's a great, great thing. Where we struggle is when we begin to consider the one who is behind all of this. Is there a personal God behind all of this? I mentioned to you last week Sam Harris, who is one of the kind of the leaders, the proponents in the new atheism movement, and he very much likes to ridicule people who believe in a personal God. However, when you read his book, The End of Faith, and you read some of his blog postings, what you will see is that this is a man who is craving something bigger than himself. I want to be very respectful here. I am not putting words in his mouth. He wants a sense of more. He talks about how he talks about Tibetan Buddhism. He talks about meditation techniques. He'll even talk to you about using mind-altering drugs that have helped him to love more. Why? Because in his being is this craving to know that there is more. But the very second you suggest that that more is a God who is personal, he's out. And I don't think he's alone in this. You see, we love the sense of awe until there's somebody who's bigger than us. And frankly, I like to be the boss of me. Now, I'm not going to take time here to try to explain or to prove the existence of God through science. That's not what I'm going to do. But when you look at this next passage, it says that Jesus is the one who holds all of this together. Now, I find that fascinating. He holds the universe. He holds the created reality together. He holds it together. There are four fundamental forces in nature. I know you know this, but let's just go over it for the person sitting next to you. There's gravity. That's what keeps you from flying off the planet at 1,000 miles an hour. It's what holds the galaxies together. There's electromagnetism, which, you know, it has a lot of uses here on the Earth. And then there are, it's called weak interaction and strong interaction. These are forces. Now, what are those? Well, weak interaction is what some of you did just a minute ago when you wouldn't talk to somebody. That was a very weak interaction. No, that's not what this is. These are subatomic forces that hold atoms together. Again, I'm not going to talk about pions and bosons and photons and Klingons because I don't really know that much about physics. But I will tell you this, when you begin to study it, there is a mystery that even the deepest minds will look at and say, we can't fully explain to you how all of this gets held together. And I find that fascinating. But what I don't want to do is to mock science because of their limit in those areas. Some people, they deal with the God of the gaps. It's an old term, but do you know what that means? It means you wait for science to have a gap in its understanding. It's like science gets to the end of itself, and then you jump in and go, aha, see, you'll never explain it. It's a mystery. That's God. The only problem with that is over the centuries, over the decades, science will explain some things and then you're left with, well, I don't know what to do. See, I'm not threatened by scientific discoveries. Don't be threatened by this. Let science begin to explain the what and the how. It's okay. When I read that they have discovered a particle that consists of two quarks, subatomic particles, that might weigh three times as much as a proton, and they start to say, maybe that's what's holding the universe together, I say, cool. That doesn't threaten my faith in God. I still believe the elegance of this universe points to a God. I'm still going to ask, who made those pesky little things? In fact, today, I don't even want to ask that. I want to ask you why. John Robert Russell is an astronomer, an astrophysicist, actually, and a Christian, and an ordained minister. I don't know where this guy finds the time for all of this, but he is that guy. And he says, if God created the universe, he says he did. He even goes further, for those of you who like string theory, if there's a multiverse, if God created multiple universes, I don't know how that works. He said, if he did that, he created this universe, and this universe supports life. Why did he do that? He goes on to say that he believes we are the signature of God's purpose for this universe. You see, if there's a God who is bigger than you can imagine, a God that is more than your wildest thoughts, and he did all of this and fine-tuned all of this so that there would be life, why would he do that? One more time. It's love. His motivation is love. He doesn't need any of us. It's love. Jesus supports this when he says, the Father knows when a sparrow falls from the sky. Jesus pays attention to little ones that are crawling all over him. He pays attention to the least of these. Jesus cares about the down and out and the up and out. He cares about the outrageously wealthy and those who were begging for food. Jesus cared for the orphan and the widow and the overeducated religious leaders and those who did not know how to read at all. Jesus cared about them all, about stay-at-home moms and dads and workers and students and business people. Jesus cared about them all. What am I saying to you? If there is a God who is big enough for all of this, he is also so loving that he cares about the minute details of your life. The Bible says he doesn't just call the stars by name. He knows how many hairs you have on your head. Only an eternal category-busting deity could do all of that. And then Paul says he's the one that holds it all together. Some of you at this point are saying, I'm out. Because as best I can tell, he's not doing a very good job. Greg, my life isn't being held together. My life is falling apart into chaos and darkness and worse things. Gang, I don't know if you know this or not, but we live in a world that is drowning in hopelessness. You don't need bad headlines of famous people who by the world's standards seemed to have it all. They had great stuff going on. They had great success. They had lots of friends. They were loved. They were respected. From the world's viewpoint, they had a great life. And then more than once these days, we are seeing people who are saying, I am overwhelmed with hopelessness, and they are making a decision from which they cannot come back. You and I are living, and some of you at this point are going, I don't think you should be talking about this at church. I don't think we can help but talk about this at church because we are the people of hope. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it isn't complicated in your life. I'm not saying that you haven't looked at a number like this sometime in the last couple of weeks and gone, I wonder if I should call somebody. You should. You should. You should talk to a friend, a counselor, a parent, a spouse, a coworker, but you should, because here is the lie. The lie is you're done, you're finished, and you have to do this alone. That's a lie. You take the next step and you ask for help, and there is no shame in that in this world, not in this church. If you come to us and say, okay, I'm having these thoughts, we will lovingly walk you to Christian counselors, but we won't drop you off at their doorstep. You're not a problem that we're outsourcing. We will walk with you together because this is what the people of God do. And for some of you, You don't even need to think about self-destructive thoughts to go, wait, I've got a kind of hopelessness. I've given up on my marriage. I've given up on my finances. I've given up on my health. I've given up on, and just go right down the line. If Jesus is who he says that he is, then he's got to hold this together, and he's good for it. This will take longer than we want, but not as long as we fear, and we will do this together, and we will be called together to do this. This is what God is inviting us into. He is the king, and he can handle this. But you and I have to take the next step. So what is the next step? You trust him. And you follow him. And you ask questions. And you listen hard. And you lock arms with somebody who maybe just has a little more in their step. And you lean on him just a little bit. And God will work through that person. And God will speak through that person. But this is what we do. Why? Because we believe that there's a God big enough and close enough that all of this matters. But gang, that's good news. How do we have that kind of hope? Where does that come from? We're back to the resurrection. You see, the good news of the resurrection is that you're not just a disillusioned skeptic with all sorts of doubts and questions. You're not just a young person who has played with fire one too many times and now you are just damaged goods. You are not just a business person who has so much success that you don't even know how you would ever get to the end of yourself. You're not just the bitter or the hurt or the abused or the confused. You're not just a 20-something heading into a quarter-life crisis or a 50-something heading dead on into a midlife crisis. Do you know who you are? You are the beloved. God did this for you. And that's good news. Some of us are so burned by this that we can't even hear the good news. Do you know why? I can talk to you about the resurrection. I can talk to you about how when the king walked out of that tomb, the world fundamentally changed. But some of us can't even hear that statement of faith because you've tried things before and those other icons, those other images, they have failed miserably. Here's my favorite quote, theologian Christopher Wright on this topic, and then we'll head for home. Here's what he says, false gods, and that's what we're chasing. False gods never fail to fail. That is the only thing about a false god you can depend on. If you are running after the wrong gods, if you are running after the wrong answers, if you are running after the wrong things that you think will carry the weight of your soul, repent and believe the good news. Don't chase after emperors and so-called gods and icons of things that will never deliver the goods. Come back to the king. He lives, he reigns, he's enough. And if Jesus is everything that I've been saying he is, then so what? Here's the so what. We owe him our allegiance. Now let me explain this and we'll finish this up. Forgive me for sounding like Johnny Science today, because I'm really not, okay? But it all kind of just fits together. Pastor, I know, talked about a moment in his Sunday school class when he was a kid that changed his life, and here it is. This woman, this godly woman, looked at these unruly boys and said, I want you to consider the distance between the sun and the earth, which is about 92 million miles. It is, consider it to be the width of this sheet of paper. And she flopped a piece of paper in front of him. So that's the width, that's 92 million miles. She said, if that's it, then the distance between earth and the nearest star is a stack of those papers 70 feet high. That's as close as we are to the nearest star. She said, if you measured the width, the diameter of our galaxy, it would be that piece of paper, 92 million miles, it would be that piece of paper stacked over 300 miles high. And she said, don't forget that our galaxy is just one little fleck of dust in an expansive universe. But if there is a God, if there is a creator, if there is a Jesus who upholds all of this by his word and holds all of it together, don't you think he wants to be more than your assistant? I'm telling you, he is the king. He is Lord.
and he deserves our allegiance. He deserves our trust. Some of us, it is time to receive that grace. Some of us, it is time to talk to somebody about getting help. Some of us, it is time to run, not walk, to some folks and talk about baptism, because you know that you belong to him now and you need to tell the world that you follow him, that your allegiance is with him. But some of us, it is time, one more time, to worship. Could we end where we started? Only this time, Aaron, let's not do it in Latin, okay? Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him.